From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of the New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The other night in Brooklyn, New Yorker staff writer Jennifer Gonerman met up with Sergeant Edwin Raymond of the NYPD.
It's quite a scene out here.
Yeah. Lincoln Terrace is pretty popular. You got basketball. Looks like somewhat of a tournament.
You got cricket here, huh?
Yeah, from Jamaica, Trinidad, Guyana, Barbados, etc. Most of the British West Indies, they play cricket.
When they met, it was past 9 at night, and Raymond had been held up for a few hours, which is certainly not uncommon if you work as a police officer.
Yeah, there was an incident with missing children, so that kind of extended the day a little bit.
Which train is that overhead?
That's the 3 train going towards New Locks.
And you used to work in the trains, right?
Correct. After the police academy, I was assigned to the Transit Bureau, and I patrolled the rails for 7 years.
Jen wanted to talk to Sergeant Raymond because he's something of a controversial figure in New York policing, a whistleblower. Raymond joined the force 10 years ago, but in 2015, he and 11 others filed a class action suit against the police department and its commissioner at the time, William Bratton. The officers became known as the NYPD 12, and the crux of their lawsuit was that the department was using monthly quotas on things like arrests and summons that officers had to meet. And the people who bore the brunt of those quotas, they said, were most often African-American and Latino residents in poor neighborhoods, places like Brownsville in eastern Brooklyn, where Sergeant Raymond currently works.
It's a challenging area. The statistics in terms of stop and frisk and quota policing, these are the areas where this stuff is applied the most. I actually purposely chose it because I felt that as someone who criticizes bad police policy, I can't go where it's easy. If I don't actually go there to see for myself, then it's just lip service.
And at what point did you start to think there might be something amiss or questionable about some of the practices you were seeing?
Even before I joined, because of what I experienced, the racial profiling, the horrible lack of professionalism from cops, I experienced those things, so I already knew something was wrong.
Was there one moment in particular when you were a teenager growing up that stands in your memory?
Yeah, absolutely. I was 18 years old. I was walking with my girlfriend at the time, and plainclothes officers jumped out and just threw me to the wall and just started illegally searching me. And they basically emptied my pockets and left everything on the floor. I was so embarrassed. And on the opposite corner, there were people watching me get searched. And in that crowd were some folks that were actually criminals. And they were watching me get searched. And I realized at that moment that to those officers, there was no difference between them and me. And the only thing I had in common with them was ancestry and, race, ethnicity. That's it. There was nothing else. At the time I was getting ready to go to college. I never smoked. I think I used to, make a little underage drinking at the time.
And then when you actually got into the academy and joined the police force, was there one moment in particular when you just thought, what is going on here? Or
so after the academy, the very first day on patrol is when I noticed that the lieutenant was fixated on just arrest summonses and stop and frisk. And, we're working in the transit system. It's a few years after 9/11. I'm assuming obviously there will be times where we have to arrest summons and possibly stop and frisk. So it's important to learn those things. But I learned that first day that that's all that mattered.
I think that's a police helicopter?
It absolutely is. Once it's hovering like that, that's aviation being called for a job.
What do you think that means?
I don't see the searchlight, so they're using probably just a fleeing someone. Could have been a shooting, and they're looking for someone on the rooftop. They're circling. Yeah, they're doing a search.
Let's break it down a little bit. Summonses. What are summonses?
Summonses are basically tickets in lieu of an arrest. So, things that are violations where instead of overwhelming the court system, the city decides to make money by issuing a summons instead. Things like public consumption of alcohol, public urination, smoking in areas that you're not supposed to smoke, being in the park after dark. You know, innocuous things that are unlawful, but, you know, there's no need to overwhelm the court system for.
Could we get a summons? We're in the park after dark.
The sign has to be there that says park closes at dusk. So if there's no sign, you're fine.
Okay, all right. What year did they officially ban quotas in New York?
So quotas were already unlawful, but there was a new bill that tightened up the loopholes that the department was able to use, and that bill became law in August of 2010.
And so when you're working in transit, and you said you were feeling pressure to get arrests, summonses, stop and frisks, what form did the pressure take? Would they say it explicitly? What would they say to you?
Well, yeah, back in 2009, there was no ambiguity. It was straight up, you know, this is what we want. They'll give exact numbers of what they want of each category, and that's all that mattered. And if you didn't meet the quota, you started getting retaliatory posts.
What would be a retaliatory post?
Just train station that's barely frequented, 20 degrees outside, and you're in an elevated outdoor train station just freezing by yourself. That's one thing. Or the police jargon, sitting on a prisoner in the hospital, meaning guarding a hospitalized prisoner.
And what was the quota that you were given back then? What were the types of numbers you were expected to hit?
They wanted 2 and 10 at times. Sometimes it'd be 4 and 20, 1 and 5. But in impact as a rookie, it's usually no less than 2 arrests, 10 summonses, and 10 stop and frisk.
Per month?
Per month. What you would get is officers that try to, you know, I put that in quotes, get it out the way early. So they'll hit the ground running the first week. And you had officers who kind of waited for it to happen organically. And if it didn't, that last few days, they started what we refer to as ice picking, which is just petty, the most innocuous things that they'll criminalize just to meet their numbers.
What would be an example of ice picking?
It's stranger than fiction. Someone biting into a jelly donut, and the hole that you insert the jelly into the donut, jelly oozing out of that hole and falling onto the platform, and the person being arrested for littering. Somebody peeling the paint off of the column in the train station, arrested for defacing transit property. It all goes back to systemic racism. The fact that what they're enforcing, they can't enforce in Park Slope, you know, white, you know, predominantly white areas, Garrettson Beach, you know, Upper West Side, but yet here they are in Flatbush, in Crown Heights, in Harlem, Mott Haven, Southside Jamaica, enforcing these things.
And when this message is being sent down the ranks, what kind of words do they use? What kind of euphemisms do they use to try to encourage?
You have to address your conditions. You have to pay the rent.
What does that mean, pay the rent?
Meet the quota. You know, make sure you pay the rent.
Now, I know if I called the NYPD today and asked them, do you have quotas? They would say, absolutely not. We have no quotas. But is it your sense that quotas still exist in the department?
Quotas absolutely still exist. Thankfully, where I work now, there are no quotas. But since I've taken such a public stance, when I'm off duty, sometimes even on duty, officers from other precincts will approach me and say, thank you for what you're doing, and share stories of what's happening today in their respective commands. Quotas are still a very real way of how the department operates. Like, those numbers are still what's incentivized. People respond to incentives. That officer that wants to make detective or go to a specialized unit doesn't have to be a genius to realize what's going to be respected and allow him or her to make it into that unit, to make it to detective.
And I remember it was 2016, right? Opening up the Sunday Times, seeing the cover of the magazine, and there was your face talking about that lawsuit. You were on the cover, and I thought, how long is this guy really going to last in the department? I mean, I don't, you know, it was such a brave thing to do. I just imagined it might be career suicide.
Yeah.
And what kind of response did you get from your fellow officers after the piece came out? Were you afraid you were going to lose your job?
I was ready to lose my job. I anticipated anything that can happen, even losing my life. And I hate to have to say losing my life, but let's be honest. You know, we saw what happened to Frank Serpico. There's no reason why something like that can't happen to me or the others. So.
But here you are.
Yeah.
Still in the department.
The article pretty much changed my life. New York Times has a lot of reach, and journalists from all around the world reached out to me. And that's when I really, truly saw just how wide Bratton's cancer had spread. As far as the Metropolitan Police in London, Gothenburg, Sweden, it was unbelievable. And I started doing more research into Bratton.
Tell us about Comstat. What role does that play in all of this?
Comstat is something that Commissioner Bratton incorporated with the broken window style of policing that he became a big fan of in the early 80s. And basically, when certain major incidents occur, like murders, rapes, grand larcenies, robberies, burglaries, you know, and shootings, when those things occur, the commanding officer is held accountable for addressing those conditions, and that's done in a Comstat meeting. And you see, if you were to stop the tape there, it seems like something noble, something good, something that makes sense. But where it becomes problematic is what's accepted as a response. In transit, for instance, say we're getting a condition, meaning something serious, like a robbery, a grand larceny, something very common in transit. People tend to look into their phones, and unfortunately, people who are up to no good snatch the phones and escape as the doors are closing. So say New Lots on the 3 line, we're getting a lot of phone snatches at 1 a.m. As long as you increase arrest at New Lots, be it 3 p.m., 4 p.m., school kids who double up through the turnstile together or probably don't have their metric cards, just keep arresting a whole bunch of school kids at 4 p.m. and you won't have to answer for the 1 a.m. robbery.
So just showing an uptick in numbers of summonses or arrests in the same location
within
is going to satisfy your bosses? Is that...
Pretty much, yeah.
When folks were calling you from other countries, were they reporters or activists? And what did they want to know? Why were they reaching out to you?
Honestly, in the early 90s, crime starts dropping. And as Mayor Dinkins' tenure ends and Giuliani's administration starts with Commissioner Bratton, who then implements the broken windows policing. Again, crime that was already plummeting continues to plummet. So broken windows pretty much gets the credit for that. This brings a lot of publicity to New York and Bratton. And so what happens is different police departments throughout the nation and world, they send representatives to learn Bratton's strategies in Comstat and quality of life, broken windows policing. And they bring back this type of policing to their respective cities. So when I say Bratton's cancer, that's what I'm referring to, the spread of broken windows, quality of life, quota policing. It really starts to spread throughout different parts of the nation and different parts of the world. And when it was reporters from other countries that were reaching out because they had issues in policing in their cities, some of them, they start getting issues with quotas. And they said, wow, okay, maybe this is responsible for what we're experiencing because, you know, we're experiencing similar things.
You know, one of the amazing things here about your story is how you somehow managed to flip the script on whistleblowing. And here we are, 2 years later, you're still on the police force, you've been promoted to sergeant. It's like the whistleblower who managed to hold on to his job, it almost never happens.
Yeah, that is quite unprecedented, which is why it gives hope to a lot of officers throughout the nation. Many officers reach out on social media platforms just saying, please keep pushing on, you know, we're having issues here. Although, you know, there's a lot of animosity, hatred, and things to be cautious about, but the support has been overwhelming at the same time.
What form does that animosity take, that hatred take?
At details, meaning like parades or large events where you'd have officers from different parts of the city working together. Officers who recognize me but are not used to seeing me, you'll see just the body language. You'll see them pointing, some of them whispering, that's the rat. You know, that's the rat. Although I'm speaking about systemic issues, although I'm speaking about the upper echelon who are in a position to change this, cops of all ranks feel personally attacked. So that shocked me, because if you really pay attention, this is actually beneficial for officers, because you don't have to be, you know, that petty officer that's going to go bother someone that just wants to take a quick shortcut through the park to get home from a late shift. You know, at first I thought officers would kind of embrace this more. I don't know. It's something I'm still learning, because if you pay attention, you should be rooting for me. You should be rooting for the NYPD 12, you know?
That was Edwin Raymond of the New York City Police Department talking with Jennifer Gonerman, a staff writer for The New Yorker. The lawsuit by Sergeant Raymond and the NYPD 12 is the subject of a new documentary that's out on Hulu, and it's called Crime and Punishment. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come. Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. When The Wire debuted on HBO over 15 years ago, I don't think it's an overstatement to say that it changed television as we knew it. The show traced the underworld and the politics and the street life of Baltimore. And it was an ambitious piece of sociology as much as it was unbelievable drama. The Wire was dense, it was challenging, and not a few people say it was the best thing ever on television. That show was the work of David Simon, and his latest project is a show called The Deuce. And what The Wire had done for the drug trade of Baltimore, The Deuce does for sex work and the rise of pornography in 1970s New York City.
So, what's it like, Shay?
Well, I'm just starting. Loretta can tell you. She's been sunlight all year.
Really?
Sunlight.
Making movies during the day.
For the machine.
The Deuce is going into its second season on HBO, and I sat down with David Simon almost exactly a year ago, just a few weeks after the first season had premiered.
As I understand it, you and George Pelicanos, your collaborator on this program, had a conversation with somebody who sparked this idea. Tell me about that.
We were working on Treme, and the assistant locations manager was a fellow named Mark Henry Johnson, and he'd encountered this guy and befriended him and taken down tape after tape after tape of his memories of being a mob front, for the mafia, for the Gambino family on 42nd Street. Ran a bar up near the Brill Building that became quite famous in its day as sort of a demi-mon joint. Ran an after-hours club later on.
What was the name of the place?
If I say that, I think it identifies him. And he's passed away, and so has his twin brother. But I kind of feel like there's a lot of kids and grandkids. And since the story is not, you know, it's not all heroics, I'm not sure that I have permission, if that makes sense.
Fair enough.
But anyway, Mark said, you got to come meet this guy. You got to hear the stories. You know, it's about the rise of pornography. It's this moment where porn went from being under the counter, back alley in the basement, to being the beginnings of a multi-billion dollar industry and a legitimate one.
And what kind of stories was he telling you?
About all the people he knew and what happened to them and who survived and who didn't and who was attrited and what happened and, you know, all the lies within the truths and truths within the lies. But we didn't know that. We thought, oh, great, it's a porn story. So George and I put him off and put him off. And finally, we had we were coming up here for a sound mix, I think, on Treme. And I said, George, you know, let's just get this all over with because, you know, it'll be an hour. We'll shake hands. We'll be at the door. 3.5 hours later, we walked out of Mark's apartment in Tribeca after listening to the guy for 3.5 hours. He wasn't done, but we pretended to go need a cigarette. Neither one of us smoke. And we walked around the block and said, my God, I think we're going to do a story about the rise of pornography. I mean, the stories were that compelling.
When the first episode opens, the world that we're in is the world of streetwalkers and pimps, not the world of porn. What happened?
Well, I mean, there was. Listen, there's been pornography since the—
No, there's been skin magazines and
right.
the rest.
Well, no, since the first French guy invented the camera
right.
and said, you know, he ran down the street looking for Parisian hookers to take their clothes off. And there's been prostitution since, you know, since I believe our testament. So nobody invented these things. But what happened around 1971 was the New York City courts began interpreting the inherent confusion over what is obscene in a very, you could either say pragmatic or laissez-faire way, which is to say we're done chasing this nonsense around to no particular point because we can't obtain convictions anywhere above an appeals court, and the Supreme Court can't even give us any real guidance. So we're going—
So it was the courts more than the sexual revolution that did this?
And there was sort of a hollowed-out notion of what is the standard. And, of course, you know, what are community standards in Times Square? They're very different from the rest of America. So it happened here, and it happened with mafia money. And— suddenly, what was under the counter in a very short span of time became legal and unregulated.
I want to play a clip from the show. There's a scene where Maggie Gyllenhaal's character, a prostitute who goes by the name of Candy, she has a kid as a client, a kid who clearly it's his first time having sex or anything close to it. And not surprisingly, he has an orgasm in no time flat, and he wants seconds.
What do you do, Stuart?
I'm in school.
What's your daddy do?
He sells cars. He's got a dealership.
And that's his job, right? Someone comes in, knows just the car he wants, doesn't dick around, doesn't need a long test drive, doesn't argue about the color or whatever. Does he give him the car for less? Does he pay less? Then the guy who comes in, takes forever, gotta drive 5 or 6 cars, talk about the radio, the white walls, everything else before he's done and ready to buy? No. He doesn't give the easy customer 2 cars for the price of 1, right? This is my job, Stuart.
There is, as there is in The Wire and everything else you do, David, a really powerful sense of labor and even the dignity of labor in this.
Even when it's undignified.
There.
That's exactly right, which is to say, I think our hearts, no matter where we go, whether it's recon Marines or trombone players or drug dealers or cops or sex workers, our hearts are either with— it's either on the assembly line or it's with middle management. You know, I think that's where our point of view is always strongest. I think that's what we're trying to convey. And then we're trying to show you, well, so where does the power and the money route itself? And if we sort of fail to do those two things, if we fail to create a world where real people seem to be laboring and trying to scratch out an existence, a plausible existence, and if we fail, I think, to address what they get and what they don't get, in more macro terms, then I think we probably screwed up our mission.
Unless I'm crazy, one of the dominant themes of this is not just systems and economies and relationships of that kind, but misogyny.
Oh, yeah.
And this is created by David Simon and George Pelicanos, and Richard Price is a dominant writer here. But your writer's room is really interesting.
Right.
Tell me
about
that.
You just played from the first few. And yes, you know, when we were trying to establish the template, I relied on the writers that, you know, I came to the dance with many years ago on the Wire. But in order to shape the whole story and to bring it to a point that it needed to be, this could in no way be the boys' version of sex work, the boys' version of pornography.
So, how do you assemble a writer's room? How many people are in it, and who's in there?
Well, I chase novelists. That's my conceit, which is I'd rather have people who know how to write a multi-POV novel than people who know how to write television. I can fix what ails a scene in terms of television. I can't fix content, and I can't fix voice.
But even in the so-called golden age of television, you don't have faith in that?
No, I don't. I don't want somebody who can deliver a clinical 43-minute and 30-episode on TV. I want somebody who can write a novel to conclusion that has a beginning, a middle, and an end. So, George was the first guy that I sort of threw it at. And then he and I went together to get Price. And then, on this one, we went for Megan Abbott and Lisa Lutz. We needed the woman's voice in the room. We needed to be argued out of our own sensibilities. We needed to be argued into other sensibilities.
Tell me about some of those arguments. Give me an example.
Trying to think. The one that I'm coming up with right now is not particularly substantive, but it's telling. There's a character named whose name in the scripts was Thunder Thighs. She's a heavyset girl heavyset woman who's working the corners. And she was named Thunder Thighs because that's what the original guy whose stories it was knew her as. We didn't have her real name. We had what he remembered her as, and that was her street name. So she was that in the script. First moment when we brought women on and they looked at the scripts and they said, can this person have a name? And instantly I think I felt a level of shame that like I didn't anticipate. It was like, she absolutely can have a name and I'm sorry.
You're way better.
Yeah, you're way better. But it was much more substantive than that. I mean, there's a conversation in one of these later episodes where the working girls are in the diner and they all just want to get rid of the pimps. And they start talking about menstruation, and they start talking about it in the most hyperbolic terms.
You hear about these sponges? You stick it up there, stops the blood long enough to fuck. Johns can't tell the difference, but you need to be careful. He gave me a yeast infection once.
Larry, one of the pimps, throws down his fork, shoves his plate away, and walks away. And then they can talk because he's not around. It was one of the most fundamentally feminist scenes in the piece, and it was, I think it was Lisa Lutz, if I'm remembering correctly, she delivered that one. So, I mean, what you're looking at is, that's something, I would not have thought to write that scene. And if I did write it, I literally would have gotten to the parts about, I would have gotten to all the, all the genital realities and said, or the venereal realities and said,
you would have run away from it.
Yeah, can a PA come in here and tell me,
I think anybody who's watching this show has got to be casting their heads forward to where this lands, which is to say porn on every phone and computer and all the rest, the ubiquity of porn and the effect it's had on...
How on men.
How do you feel about the effect of porn on society?
Well, listen, I come from newspapers. I'm a First Amendment literalist. I don't see any means to regulate speech, open speech, but I think this has happened so fast that we've gone from, in 50 years, from stealing your dad's Playboy or Penthouse magazine for a 12-year-old to having any form of pornography, regardless of how sort of misogynistic the imagery might be available at your fingertips without intercession to that same 12 or 13-year-old. We've gone so fast. I'm not sure we've taken stock of just how profoundly.
You think it's affected consciousness in a way?
Absolutely. I certainly think it's even affected political consciousness in the country. I don't think some of the things that were said in this last campaign cycle and accepted, and not just the pussy grabbing, which is, of course, the most startling moment. I mean, if you think back two political generations, maybe one and a half to Jimmy Carter, and lusting in his own heart in 1976. A very Christian, very sincere comment when asked about infidelity, that he had lusted in his own heart for other women. It nearly capsized his campaign. Trump barely broke stride after the tape came out. It was really a remarkable moment of...
And you think that's linked somehow to porn?
I think the blunt ubiquity of pornography has made the terminology and the demeanor with which men address women now, I think it's transformed it, yeah. And I think you really see it in, give men the slightest bit of anonymity. You have a lot of writers at The New Yorker. I imagine that what comes across the transom in terms of social media or comments at women more than men, you know, never fail. I mean, women are used to it. If you ever get used to it, women have now been putting up with it for 10, 15 years of the internet. It's astonishing. I'm, you know, my wife is a novelist. What comes across at women nowadays?
She gets letters, she gets emails.
You know, she has a website, you know. And I mean, you know, you kill it out and you keep moving. And you know, obviously the anonymity is part of the dynamic. But what men feel entitled now to say and to think and to even argue, I think is entirely informed by a 50-year run-up.
That porn itself influences the misogyny directed at a
candidate. And the misogyny pushes porn. I mean, I think it's quite a cycle.
All these projects and all your reporting and all your thinking in your adult life has led you to have what politics, David?
I'm lefty.
How lefty?
You know what? I'm left-wing on about 85% of the issues.
And where not?
I got no patience for anything that interrupts the idea of open speech. I find what's going on college campuses to be incredibly naive, almost childlike. I'm very disappointed in it. I think dissent, open dissent, requires speech in order to survive, particularly in a time of an authoritarian government. And the idea that you would trade that away over some schnook that's saying some stupid stuff in a Berkeley lecture hall is embarrassing to me. It's like, you would trade this weapon for that? That's not even tactical. So there are moments where I just walk, I listen to the left and I walk away and I say, man, you know, you never fought the way it has to be fought in your life, and that's why you just came up with that answer. But there are other times where I find myself to the left of the Democratic platforms. I mean, you know, I think there should be a graduate guaranteed income. I think we've reached the point in terms of the death of work and where we're going as a society and automation that we should already be guaranteeing people a basic income, which, frankly, Richard Nixon got close to doing.
He did.
And was told, this will work. You know, you give somebody $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, you give families that kind of money, it's all going back into the economy. It's not going into mutual funds. It's going right back. It's going right back into the economy. It would be an incredible boon to the country, and it would honestly take into account the fact that we don't need as many Americans to run this economy as we once did.
You started out as a journalist and a damn good journalist, and I think you have a kind of love and some hate relationship to what lingers in journalism. How do you feel about it now, and do you have any plans to sort of make anything more than an op-ed like a reentry into journalism?
You know,
because I could think of a good place for you to write.
Is that an invitation?
It's always been an invitation.
Well, I owe you a piece.
You do.
I owe you a piece. I mean, there are parts of me that think there's going to come a point where you don't want to sit in those goddamn deck chairs at 4 in the morning at 164th Street, you know, and wait for them to move the light. And at that point, maybe you should be writing prose again.
All right, then I'm patient.
Because then it's you and it's an editor and a copy editor and maybe a photographer.
Well, I'll wait for that day, and in the meantime, I'm loving this work.
Oh, well, thank you.
David, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
David Simon, season 2 of The Deuce, which he created along with George Pelicanos, comes out next month on HBO. Eun Lee is a fiction writer who's published some great short stories and essays in The New Yorker going back to 2003. Lee grew up in Beijing in the 70s. She was a child of the communist regime, and as a teenager, she spent a year in the Chinese army. After dark, though, she'd pull out her journal from where it was hidden under her bed, and as often as possible, she'd lose herself reading American novels. She moved to the States after college and started writing her own books in English, her second language. Lee eventually settled in Oakland, California, in the Bay Area, and she took us to one of her favorite places in the city.
It is really a melancholy day for East Bay or for the Bay Area. It's wet and cold and chilly and windy. So it's a great day to visit a cemetery in a way. So this is the entrance, and so there's a main avenue. We are driving in Mountain View Cemetery in Oakland, California. Wherever I go, I visit cemeteries. You know, I love Paris, and mostly I go to cemeteries. And when we visited Zagreb, we walked all the way uphill to I think, one of the oldest cemeteries in Central Europe. And in Ireland, of course, you know, in America too. I think part of the reason I'm drawn to cemeteries, I think there are a lot of human stories buried in cemeteries. And I write fiction, so I like to imagine lives already lived and lives that are in the past, so I can reimagine their lives. And then I could make up a story. I think that's the main road, and we can try to go up on the other side. You know, this is very much hilly California, Berkeley. It's all hills. And so all the roads are winding around the hill. And I think a lot of cemeteries, you can easily find, you know, each lot who is buried there. And here it's a little difficult because it's a little bit like a maze. And every time you walk up there, you find new things. Look at this. I don't know what this tree is. It's beautiful. And I think sometimes you notice names that you know right away, like Ghirardelli, the chocolate person. And some of the names are interesting to me, I think, mostly because of the local history. You know, I'm not from California. I immigrated from China, and so I thought, you know, it doesn't matter if I'm from elsewhere. Once I settle here, I want to know a little bit of this place. I want to know what happened. The making of California is almost like in itself a little story about this nation, which to me is interesting. Different nationalities, different ethnicities, and I always imagine the people I read in the book, some of them probably are buried here. So now we're on top of the hill, and if you look afar, you can see San Francisco. But look at here, George J. Mazzanti. So if you see, it's two hearts, and that is Angelo Guy Mazzanti. So it's a five-year-old little boy with a little picture of a five-year-old boy that says forever young. So, you know, the grandfather died in 1990 and the grandson died in 1988. So the grandfather outlived the son for almost 2 years. And just think about that man, how that man felt. I like this plot a lot because they are from different places. A lot of immigrants buried here. United States ambassador to the federal state of Micronesia. California Secretary of State, California State Assemblyman. So this is a Chinese American who held all these positions. And this is an old-fashioned Chinese character that looked almost like paintings. To me, it's interesting as a writer. You need years of accumulation to understand the place. So I think I've written about China for 10, 12 years now, I think. But now I've lived in California for a little bit over a decade now. I realize California is coming into my fiction too. So more and more California feels native to me in a way, you know, looking at the trees, the land. I've been working on this novel, and one of the main characters, really the narrator, she's an old woman, and she actually, in my imagination, she's in a retirement home not far from here, probably like 5 minutes away. And she, in my imagination, would one day be buried here.
Yoon Lee at Mountain View Cemetery in Oakland, California. Her most recent book is a collection of essays called Dear Friend, From My Life I Write to You in Your Life. In a moment, we'll talk life and death with the beloved songwriter Nick Lowe. Stick around. I'm David Remnick, and next week on the show, The New Yorker's Eliza Griswold talks with Franklin Graham. Graham, who's the son of Billy Graham, is one of the most influential evangelical leaders in America, and they'll talk about Donald Trump, Vladimir Putin, and why Graham thinks both men have helped the cause of conservative Christians. That's next week on The New Yorker Radio Hour.
Okay. So this is downtown Piermont.
Nice. It looks like I'll be able to get a fancy coffee here.
Yes. Is that something you would like?
Yes, I think it is.
The Sidewalk Bistro looks like the place.
Last summer, The New Yorker's Nick Paumgarten met up with one of his heroes, the singer and songwriter Nick Lowe.
Hi, Mr. Lowe.
Hello, how are you? I'm well, thank you.
Yeah? Playing in the area?
Yeah.
Where?
I'm afraid that information is top secret.
Oh, God.
Like Lowe made it big as a pioneer of what the English called pub rock, a kind of back-to-basics rock movement that swept Britain in the 70s.
Oh, I can't take another heartache, though you say you're my friend, but I'm at my wit's end. You say your love is bona fide, but that don't coincide with the things that you do.
Nick Lowe and Nick Paumgarten met a few years ago, and they went shopping for eyeglasses for some reason. Lowe wears these big, thick, heavy black frames that are a sort of signature look for him. And last summer, Paumgarten decided to catch up with Nick Lowe again.
Nick Lowe is this tall, blonde, geeky guy with glasses. Except he's not blonde. He's got this great shock of white hair. And he's not really geeky either. He's actually about as cool as they come. The Jesus of Cool, they call him, after an album of his from 1978.
I remember the night the kid cut off his right arm, did a bit to save a bit of power. He got 50,000 watts in a big acoustic tower.
Nick was staying near a town called Piermont on the Hudson River. He was playing some gigs nearby. One morning, he and I went for a walk around town.
Just before I came away.
A few weeks before, he had lost one of his dearest friends and co-conspirators, his longtime producer, Neil Brockbank. And he was pretty broken up about it.
This was Neil.
Neil Brockbank.
Oh, yes. Thank you for knowing, mate. He was way more than a friend, really. He was he worked for me for years, and we collaborated. He used to produce my records. He also used to tell me if something I did was complete shit. Well, he died unexpectedly and really threw me for quite a loop. There was me, a fellow called Bobby Irwin, and Neil. And now I'm the only one of those left. The other two are now dead.
Bobby died a couple of years ago.
Yeah, that's right. Both of lung cancer. Smoke like chimneys.
I've been interested for a while in how rock and roll artists handle getting older. Some do the Mick Jagger thing. They pretend they're still Jumping Jack Flash. Some go the Rod Stewart route. They sing It Had to Be You. But Lowe found a different way to go about it. He started writing and performing these low-key, suave, cheeky little gems, played with poise and panache.
I'm 61 years old now. Lord, I never thought I'd see 30. Though I know this road is still some way to go, I can't help thinking on, will I be beloved and celebrated for my masterly climb? Or just another bum when it comes to checkout time?
The thing was for me to accept the fact that I was getting older, and to actually sort of embrace it and use it as a sort of an advantage instead of trying to hide it or being embarrassed about it, you know. Some of my colleagues and associates have to do that, really, behave like they did when they were young. And I wanted to avoid that rubbish, you know, at all costs. And it sort of worked. It gave us the excuse, you know, to do almost whatever we wanted.
Yes, and when it's time to pay the bill, I'm gonna get my bag and then I will throw it in the first cab in line.
I saw him perform recently at Lincoln Center, and in some ways, he seemed better than ever. But still, this getting older business, the deaths of old friends, it's all caused him to think a little bit more about his father. His dad was an officer in the Royal Air Force.
And when was this? This was after the war?
Yeah. So although he joined the Air Force in the 1930s, when it was... I don't think back then there was anything cooler you could have done than be an RAF pilot. It was like being in U2. You know, he himself was from a military family, but his parents really treated him rather badly, actually. They seemed to do their best to avoid seeing him as much as they could. So they were in India. They sent him to boarding school in the UK, and in the holidays, instead of going out to India like a lot of them did, you know, he used to go and stay with his friend of his parents. He's out on his bike one day. He was about 14 or 15, I think, and he saw a plane in the sky, and it landed in a field. And my dad asked the pilot if he could get a job, you know, in the wherever the airfield was that he'd come from, which wasn't very far away. He got a job sweeping up and cleaning out the place, and in return for that, this guy gave my dad flying lessons. And he learned to fly, and as soon as he could, he joined the Air Force. And he always used to say that the Air Force became sort of his family.
I live on a battlefield, surrounded by the ruins of the love we built, and then destroyed between us, the smoke has cleared. As I stumble through the rubble, I'm a dazed, seeing double, and I'm truly mystified. My new home is a shell hole.
I gather your father didn't know what to make of the music you were making or the music you were into. He wasn't. He's from.
No, he didn't. He didn't really get it. You know, he was sort of disappointed. You know, my mum was my big champion. You know, she sort of taught me how to play the guitar and.
She was a musician, sing. Your mother?
Yeah, she came from a show business family, in fact. So she encouraged me like mad, and even when I brought home some of my really terrible records, you know, she made my dad listen to them, poor chap. But the only record I actually saw him put on was when we first got a stereo, and he bought this record which was of trains pulling into the station. I don't think he had a clue what stereo was, but when he heard this record of trains pulling into the station, he put that on, he could, you know, and the train noise would go from one speaker to the other, and he'd say, yes, come over here, you can hear it, but yes, I think this is better over here, yes. You know, stepping over into the different parts of the... No, if you come here, you come here in all its magnificence, you know.
Yeah.
That cheered him right up.
Not for him, Sergeant Peppers.
Nothing like that.
When did your father die?
It's probably about 12 years ago now. something like that.
And had he come around to what you were doing
at this point? He had totally got it. By this time, I suppose I had more actual visible success. When I was on the TV all the time and actually getting records in the charts.
Late 70s, 80s.
Yeah, he didn't really like that stuff very much. He liked the later stuff much more. Yes, it was rather sad. When he was dying in hospital, I went to see him, and he had this RAF moustache all his life, even from the very early pictures of him. He had this handlebar moustache, you know, sort of cliche in a way, you know, except he had one in the 1930s.
Right.
And I came to see him shortly before he died, and someone had shaved half of it off. They'd obviously come around to shave him.
Yeah.
And their hand had slipped or something like that, and they'd go, oh dear, but they just left him with half a moustache. It was very, very sad and poignant moment. Yeah. He didn't know anything about it, but I thought, oh man, this is
the indignity.
This is very, very bad.
Yeah.
Very bad form indeed.
You didn't have to tell him.
No, I didn't tell him. But he saw me. For a man, he always thought that the greatest pop record ever made was Limbo Rock by Chubby Checker. And he said to me one night when he'd had a few drinks, he said, why would anybody bother with this stuff anymore? It's impossible to beat it, you know. So, the majesty of Bridge Over Troubled Waters, you know, moved him not. You know, Imagine could have been anything, you know. Limbo Rock, Chubby Checker. Every limbo boy and girl all around the limbo world, the military world, you know, felt totally natural to me. You know, I've never recoiled in horror from all that marching. You know, I used to think, oh, well, this all makes sense, you know, because I was raised in it. And I would have liked to have been in the Air Force as well. You know, I would been a pilot. I would have loved it. But I wasn't nearly bright enough to tackle the maths and all the other stuff, and to apply myself. And in any case, by that time, rock and roll had come along, and I was, you know, its willing slave.
It wasn't so much rebellion for you as it was just following a life that interested you.
Yes.
And that would have you, a life that would have you.
And a life that would have me. How well put. Yes, yeah. It was a life that would have me, exactly.
In my life, I've done things I'm not proud of, and too often watched my dreams turn to sand. But it looks like I might have turned a corner. You make me want to be a better man. There's no new leaves left for me to turn over. I'm in a prison built by my own hand. I pray at last I found salvation. You make me want to be a better man. I can't go on living this way, and that's a fact. I know you understand. I don't know much, but one thing's for certain. You make me want to be a better man.
Nick Lowe. He'll be on tour starting in Texas next month, and he spoke with The New Yorker's Nick Palmgarten. And that's it for the show today. We hope you'll join us next week. And in the meantime, make sure to follow us on Twitter at New Yorker Radio. Have a great week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Toon Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Cal Alia, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, Stephen Valentino, and Richard Yeh, with help from Terrence Bernardo, Michelle Moses, Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. This week, we're saying a special thanks and a fond farewell to our colleague Mythili Rao. Good luck across the pond. They're lucky to have you. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.